You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Now, tonight, I'm going to be taking us through 2 Corinthians 12, 1 through 10. We're going to be ending on what might be one of the more familiar passages from the book of 2 Corinthians, one that people find themselves turning back to again and again, but also in some ways, one that is the most confusing, one that that says things that, you know, you sometimes you want to write it on like a refrigerator verse type thing or like a wall hanging, but then you actually really think about it and you're like, what does this mean? And I'm excited to get into this tonight. And it's been an honor to be here with you guys. It's been a great weekend. Let me pray one more time. Lord, I thank you that for all the things that we've gone through in the last few years, Lord, but not even just the last few years, God, we've been on a journey with you. We've been on a journey with you for many decades, Lord. You've drawn us from all over, God, from different parts of the city, different walks of life. And we are just so thankful, God, to be servants in your kingdom. We're so thankful, God, that we get the opportunity and the time to come to a place like this, to have fellowship together. And I pray, Lord, that as we end this weekend, God, that you'd be showing each of us what you want us to take away from both the times of fellowship and also the times of teaching, and that you would empower us, Lord, through your word to go be the people that you've called us to be, Lord. We are deeply grateful to be here and to be in your presence. Amen. So tonight we'll be talking about every American's favorite topic. We're going to be talking about limitations. Limitations and weaknesses. However, we'll be talking about the way in which these can actually enable spiritual power and bring us into a place of strength. Paul says, "It is necessary to go on boasting, though it is not profitable. I will go on to visions and revelations from the Lord." If you've been following along in the book of 2 Corinthians, it's kind of funny because you can wonder, has Paul actually been boasting? I mean, the guy's basically just been listing all of the terrible things that have happened over the course of his life in serving God. Beaten, shipwrecked, really stressed out. It's not exactly a highlight reel, is it? But yet Paul says that he will boast about these things. He will boast about his weaknesses. We have to remember that in the ancient world, people didn't view victimhood as somehow enhancing credibility the way that we do today. When people saw this kind of thing happening to a so-called great spiritual man, their first thought was like, dude, you're doing it wrong, okay? Like, this is not the way it's supposed to work. It'd be like if you had like a roommate or a buddy and they came home and they had just like, they were come back from working out and they had like blood just dripping out of their ears. And you're like, dude, what is going on? And they're like, no, it's okay. I know what I'm doing. I'm like 11 from Stranger Things. It just happens when I go hard, you know, like, you're doing it wrong. But Paul's been doing this really intentional thing throughout the course of 2 Corinthians, especially the second half, where he's been flipping the script for these guys. He's questioning their measurement system. He keeps repeating this phrase that if I must boast, I will boast about the things that show my weakness. I'll boast about the things that show my weakness. What if the true marks of apostleship, because he was contending with these guys who claimed to be apostles, they were claiming spiritual authority, but what if the true marks of apostleship are something other than wealth and applause? What if there are things that are deeper, more telling that God is actually leading and working through a person's life? And so to demonstrate that, he says, I have to tell you about my weaknesses, because those weaknesses are going to tell you something about God. With that being said, though, he's okay with not just talking about his lowest lows. He's also all right talking a little bit about his highest highs. He says, I will go on to visions and revelations from the Lord, reluctant though I may be. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know, God knows, was caught up into the third heaven, he says. Now, despite Paul's kind of weird third-person language, it's pretty obvious that he's talking about himself. Commentators agree that this is sort of a way of kind of pushing away credit. It's a way of communicating humility. But he describes this great vision that he had. It probably would have happened around 42 AD. This is when he still was living around Tarsus. He'd fled there from the city of Damascus. This is before anybody knew Paul's name. This is before, I mean, they still knew Paul's name, but they knew it for the wrong reasons, right? This is before anybody knew him as the great missionary church planter. He was still just learning the ropes out there in the wilderness surrounding his hometown. And it was during this time that God gave him this great vision of what he calls the third heaven. This wasn't the third heaven in the sense of like, you know, a third level of heaven. They used the word heaven generically to describe both the sky, the stars, and then finally, the third heaven would be the realm where God dwells. And so Paul was given this vision of his future home. Imagine what that would have been like. I mean, I can't imagine what it would have been like. It's unimaginable. That's literally what he says. He says, and I know that this man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know. God knows. He said that twice now. Was caught up into paradise and heard things too sacred to be put into words. Things that a person is not permitted to speak. And so it's interesting. It's interesting that God gave him this great vision that apparently was kind of sacred to him. It was something which he felt like he couldn't just talk about it all the time because it was very personal in its intention. It had the goal of building him up in some way, preparing him, no doubt, for the wild life that he was about to live. I mean, just imagine, you know, if you were going to live a life like Paul's, how helpful it would have been to have a clear view of what you were working towards. I mean, I felt that way after reading Randy Alcorn's book on heaven, that like my vision was clarified of what I was working towards. Imagine actually seeing it, right? And I think that visions like these, you know, great spiritual experiences like these often do have two different intentions, two different targets in some way. I think sometimes the target is individual. Often primarily there's a message for the person who experiences something like this. I remember when we had that really mind-blowing experience on our elders' retreat a few years ago. There was a message that was given in tongues, and it was primarily for a specific person in the room. But it was followed by a secondary prophecy that was a message of encouragement for the whole church. And so while Paul had this experience, and it was something which must have been intensely private for him, we also know that it influenced his ministry. We also know that this probably informed the way he spoke and taught on the subject of heaven in the last days. And so his friends, the people that he reached also benefited from this great vision that God had given him, which really motivated him throughout the course of his entire life. He says, on behalf of such an individual, I will boast, but on my own behalf, the man who doesn't deserve such great things, he says, I will not boast except my weaknesses. I'll not boast except my weaknesses. This word weakness is actually a word with a wide semantic range. In Greek, it can mean incapacity, experience of limitation, ineffectualness, or reasons for lack of confidence. That kind of covers the whole gambit, doesn't it? Does anybody else find it strange that Paul wanted to talk about these things instead? If I'd seen heaven, I'd want to talk about it. In fact, if you saw heaven, I want to talk about it. Paul felt kind of weird about it. He felt like it was something he didn't want to talk about because he was afraid that it would be distracting in some sense. That's what he goes on to and talks about next. It is kind of strange. I mean, I remember just a few years ago, a guy came into my home church through a collaborative plant. And he sat down with me in this big group of people. There was like 20 people on our front porch. And he was like, so dude, like, what are your besetting sins? I mean, I'm not opposed to opening up. That's not exactly my preferred icebreaker question. I was like, sure, man, let's go one for one. You start, you know? So is that the spiritual thing to do, just to sit around and compare your failures? Or is Paul getting at something else? I think he's getting at something else. He says, for even if I wish to boast, I would not be a fool, he says, for I'd be telling the truth. But I refrain from this so that no one may regard me beyond what he sees in me or what he hears from me, even because of the extraordinary character of the revelations that were given to me. You know, Paul knew the risk of being the kind of person that weights your authority on visions and dreams and things like that. False teachers throughout the course of history, both old and new, have weighted their claims on the basis of things that they have supposedly seen and experienced, but yet these experiences are subjective And they're unconfirmable on some level, even when they're true. Even when they're true. And so Paul wanted to be followed, but he wanted to be followed for the right reasons. He said that I refrain from this because I don't want anyone to regard me beyond what he sees in me or what he hears from me. It's always better when people can pay closer attention to the content of a person's teaching and also the manner of their life. It's true that, you know, great inspiring stories, you know, they really do have a place. They're really important. In fact, I'm sure there's some of us here in this room who could stand to be a little bit more inspiring in our leadership, right? Maybe you know, tell some people some war stories, you know, something that shows them, you know, what their lives could be. It's like, that's an important mechanism of leadership to share those kinds of things, but it's not all of it. There's a balance in leadership between inspiration and instruction that has to be struck so that God is the one who ultimately is glorified. I think when we're trying to inspire people, you know, people who've had great experiences, they have stories to share. And like I said, those stories are good. But instruction is really about, biblical instruction is about delivering people objective truth. It's about informing them about the nature of Christ, pointing them to Jesus. When inspiration gets overused, it can have the effect of drawing people to yourself. Because people think the inspirer is very cool and spiritual and awesome, right? And again, that's not necessarily always inappropriate. But when overused, that's what happens. And the person is magnified rather than Christ. That's something which Paul was concerned about with these teachers who had arrived in Corinth. Finally, I think that there's a practical element in this too. Really, you know, people that lean heavily on inspiration are often influential as long as people kind of remain within their orbit. But the thing about inspiration is that it's great for getting people moving. It's great for getting you a core conviction. But sometimes it's not enough to be inspired by the stories and the experiences and the charisma of someone else. You need some meat. You need something that you're going to be able to chew on and digest long after that person is gone if you're going to keep going. And so to put it another way, when inspiration is overused, it can create followers. But it's really biblical instruction that creates disciples. And so Paul wanted to be followed, but he wanted to be followed for the right reasons. He was wary of drawing undue attention to himself and getting people to think more of him than was actually warranted and in some way taking away from the glory of Jesus Christ. Well, the good news, or the bad news, depending on how you look at it, is that it's not just up to us to deal with this and to arrive at the right place if we're someone who has had great experiences with God. He says, therefore, so that I would not become arrogant, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to trouble me, so that I would not become arrogant. This word arrogant means to have an undue sense of one's own importance. And it's a danger. It's a danger for anyone who is following God and serving God because, like Jesus said to his own disciples, you will see greater things than these. He said, you know, following God involves suffering, but it also does involve mountaintop experiences. We get to be a part of amazing things. In fact, most of the people in this room have gotten to see miracles in different ways and different times in their own home churches. In the course of leading in this church, we have seen God shake foundations. But there is a danger that people can become arrogant. Arrogance is dangerous for many different reasons. One of the most dangerous things about arrogance is that it actually blinds you to your limitations. It makes it so that you don't expect your weaknesses. One of the famously least limited people who's ever lived was Alexander the Great. Okay, this guy, famed military commander. At a young age, he conquered the entire Mediterranean world in like the most brutal of ways. But even this man, maybe one of the most, I mean, he was trained by Aristotle himself, who was trained by Plato. You know, all the advantages, but even he had limits. It was called the Hyphasis River in India. That was his limit. That's how far his charisma and everything else could take him, because once he got there, his men mutinied. Once he got there, on the way home, he eventually fell sick and he died. And he left no disciple, he left no children, and he left no empire because everything that he built crumbled in his wake. And this is a picture in some ways, a cautionary tale of what a person can look like if they draw the wrong conclusions from their success and don't come to grips with some of their own weaknesses, some of their own errors, maybe even some of their own problems. And so what Paul says is that God did not leave me vulnerable to this. He intervened by giving me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan sent to trouble me. In Greek, this word means anything barbed or pointed. And, you know, I don't really know what Paul's talking about here. People debate it. They're like, you know, maybe it was a besetting sin of some kind. The guy in my home church would have been really happy about that. But I think more likely it's a physical ailment. We don't really know what it is. But what we do know is that God provided a sharp reminder for Paul. He allowed a sharp reminder to persist in his life that in some sense kept him in check. Isn't that interesting to think about? Well, Paul, he identified it as being from Satan. He said it wasn't a good thing. He called out to God and he said, I asked him three times that it would depart from me. But he said to me, my grace is enough for you. My power is made perfect in your weakness. God said no. In fact, he actually said no three times. Apparently, Paul didn't ask a fourth time. But he asked three times and God said no. And what he said is, my grace is enough for you. Sometimes in this life, there are these either or situations where you can either have this circumstance go away now, you can either be healed of whatever this might be, or you can have an uninterrupted sense of your need for God's grace and power in your life and ministry. Sometimes God in his wisdom knows that those are the two options. It's one of those two things. And in Paul's case, when Paul said, Lord, please take this away from me, what God said is, I want you to have the other thing. It's better for you. It's better for you to have the other thing. In Cambodia, they've got these massive animals called water buffalo, okay? It's like my favorite animal. I love water buffalo. They're not dumb and emaciated like Cambodian cows. They're actually these like really powerful, like intelligent beasts. Every now and then I feel kind of jealous that Ryan's the only one who gets like a strong animal nickname of some kind. But you know, water buffalo just doesn't roll off the tongue. And even if it did, I mean, who am I kidding? I'm probably a golden retriever, if anything. So I don't have the disposition, you might say. But you know, what's really interesting about these animals is that even when they're domesticated, these really powerful, intelligent animals, when they're domesticated, farmers still have to fashion these. They have different ways of doing it, but they fashion these poles that have pointed ends that go on the ox, that go on the water buffalo's yoke. And the purpose of this is that even though these water buffalo have been domesticated and they've been dedicated in all their strength to like a good thing, to plowing fields, to feeding families, etc., they still need a reminder that they can't do whatever they want. They still need to have a sense of limitations. They need to know it's like, okay, you know, you can't just like gore the other one next to you. You can't go running that direction. And rather than allowing them to experience that the hard way, they put this thing in there that basically means so if they jerk that direction, they'll get poked. And I think there's an analogy here because we too are powerful and noble creatures. God has instilled us with incredible gifts. And he could deal with us in different ways. He can mute our gifts. You know, he can make us less strong. He could take things away. But oftentimes, instead, what he does in order to refine our gifts and our impact is he leaves us with things that just let us know there's only certain places you can go. And that's a mechanism that actually has the power to keep us on track in an extremely important way. So then, says Paul, I will boast most gladly about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may reside in me. I'll boast gladly about my weaknesses, he said. I'll talk about them because I see in a real sense that they are allowed, that they are from God. He says that he does this so that the power of Christ may reside in him. You know, it's not wrong to ask that God would take these things away. I mean, that's exactly what Paul did, right? He said three times, I asked him to take these things away. Often the weaknesses, often the failures, often the limitations in our lives are the products in some sense of living in a sinful world. And so it's not that we should be like ascetically happy about them. It's more so that if we understand that we have put them before God and said, God, why won't this go away? We can step back And we can welcome and understand that they must be allowed there for a purpose. And conscious weakness is something which should lead us to dependence on God's power. It's something which he wants for us. My daughter, Thea, she's 5 years old. You may have seen her just riding up and down the elevators in the embassy suites all weekend long. So Thea is actually prone to really severe night terrors. She has these, it's been better recently, which, you know, is really cool, but she goes through these kinds of like seasons, ebbs and flow, where she has these extreme night terrors, which can be hour-long episodes in the middle of the night, between like 3 and 4 a.m., where she is screaming, crying. She's completely unconscious. It's like a form of sleepwalking. She runs around the house, and she has hurt herself and hurt us in the midst of these episodes. There's been weeks where it's happened every night, sometimes multiple nights, times a week. So it's multiple nights, multiple times a night throughout the entire course of the week. And I don't know why God has not taken that away. I've prayed that God would cause that to stop. And I don't know why it hasn't stopped. It feels demonic. We've rebuked Satan. I don't know why it hasn't fully changed. But what I do know is that on the nights that that happens, I'm usually up for hours in prayer, something I would not normally do. I'm not Martin Luther. I don't do that kind of stuff. So I'm often up for hours for prayer. I know that it's caused me to be vulnerable and emotional with the people that I lead. And so in a real sense, I have been limited by the circumstance. But in another real sense, I have become more spiritually powerful because of this thing that God has allowed to persist in my life. Well, final verse, Paul says, "Therefore I am content with weaknesses and insults, with troubles, with persecutions and difficulties, for the sake of Christ. For whenever I am weak, then I am strong." That's right. That's basically the point that I just made. It's important, though, that whenever we encounter these things in our lives, that we avoid ego-driven responses to the limitations that God allows to persist in our lives. I know that a lot of people in my generation, we just had kids in the last 5 years. We love our kids. They're amazing. They're beautiful. But they're also like named Limitation 1 and Limitation 2. And a lot of people, you know, when you first encounter like a barrier, like something which makes you feel like you can't do what you used to do or makes you feel like you're not what you used to be, there's a range of responses that we can have. A lot of us, I know certain friends have been given to shame. They felt guilt and shame because they felt like, you know, I'm somehow less of a leader now. I'm less of a servant of God because I can't operate the same ways that I used to be able to operate. I know many of you here who have suffered health conditions have had similar sorts of thoughts of just kind of feeling benched in some way. And we have to understand that while it's reasonable that we would struggle with those things, the fact that we believe those kinds of things, and the fact that we start kind of throwing out like, well, maybe my best days of leadership are behind me. Or the fact that we start concluding like, you know, I don't know if I can really disciple anymore, whatever it might be, it is ultimately ego that drives those kinds of conclusions. The reason is because we are measuring what's possible in our lives on the basis of how we've felt in the absence of this weakness, in the absence of these limitations. But yet God has allowed them to come into our lives, whatever it might be. Obviously, kids are a great thing, but I mean, but other terrible things in our lives are difficult things as well. What God wants us to understand is that there's a real sense that when you are weak, you can also be strong. When you are weak, you can also be strong because it can lead you to unique types of spiritual strength. Where all of a sudden you are in the middle of an important exchange, your old capacities for the new capacities and power of God. I want to read this well-worn for good reasons quote from Watchman Nee. He says, "One day our own resources, our power, our toil, our faithfulness will all proclaim to us their vanity. This lesson is not easily learned. The hopes of so many are still centered not on the blessing of the Lord, but on the few loaves that are in their hands. It is so pitifully little we have in hand, and yet we keep reckoning with it. And the more we reckon, the harder the work becomes. What is blessing? It is the working of God where there is nothing to account for his working. When five loaves provide food for 5,000 and leave 12 baskets of fragments, that is blessing. When the fruit of your service is all out of proportion to the gifts that you possess, that is blessing. Many of us only expect results commensurate with what we are in ourselves, but blessing is fruit that is all out of correspondence with what we are. If we set our hearts in the blessing of the Lord, we shall find things happen that are altogether out of keeping with our capacity and that surpass even our wildest dreams. Yeah, I love that. I love that idea that even less of me, more dependent on God, could actually accomplish a lot more. I love that idea. And I think that it's encountering these kinds of weaknesses and limitations in our lives that often forces us to a point where we have to reckon with that. We have to really decide, is that something which I believe? Or have I become comfortable at my level of expertise and effectualness up until this point? As the world changes, as our culture changes, new things are demanded of us. Our ministry is changing. But yet, rather than view that as just an unfortunate thing, you know, we can't go back to the 90s. Some of us don't want to, and that's fine. We can't go back to the way that things used to be, but what we can do is look at what God has given us in this moment, and we can say to ourselves, Lord, because of who you are, I know this is enough. It's enough. It's more than enough, in fact. And then we have the opportunity to then see that God does things that are completely non-commensurate with who we are and what we think ourselves to be. Let me just draw a few conclusions for us. The funny thing about limitations is that they actually can enable or be integral to new experiences of strength. Think about the ways in which you can actually be a better leader if you become more in touch with your own weaknesses. For instance, think about knowledge. You know, the person who knows that they're limited in knowledge tends to not judge the ministries of other people so broadly. The person who's in touch with the fact that they that they lack knowledge, they're limited in their understanding, they don't throw up their hands in the air and say, I've tried everything. They keep searching faithfully because they know that God can show a way forward. There's like, I know there's things that I don't know. There's rocks that are still unturned. And so there's a humility that you can have instilled by coming into contact, sometimes roughly, with the fact that you're just limited in your knowledge. You don't know it all. Power, control, you know, people who know that they're limited in these things, for one thing, they're way more tolerable to be around. That's good. But second of all, we know that people who know their limits in these areas are more quickly driven on their knees to prayer. They go to God much more quickly. They don't wait until every other box has been checked. They begin with prayer when they know the limits of their power. They look at the new guy coming out to their group. They look at the person they're reaching out to and they're like, yeah, on a horizontal field, nothing's happening here. Nothing is going to happen here if it's just me, my resources, and this person in front of me. When you know your limits, when you are in touch with your weakness, then you are able to depend on the supernatural power of God. It's amazing that the weak person can actually be spiritually powerful in very important ways. All right, second ending thought. We too have seen extraordinary things in this fellowship. And quite frankly, I think we should talk about them more. I think that's a good thing. I actually don't think that the message of this chapter is don't talk about your dreams, your visions, don't talk about your mountaintop experience, your highs. Paul did that. Paul would give his testimony in front of thousands of people and talk about being knocked on his butt on the Damascus Road and seeing Jesus in front of him being like, why are you persecuting me? Like, that's pretty crazy, you know? So it's not that we shouldn't talk about those things. I actually think the people in our home churches need to hear about some of the great things that God has done in your life, in the lives of your friends, and also in different corners of this church. There's some of you who I don't know you personally, but I've heard your stories, and I tell your stories to the 19-year-olds coming to Christ in my group. And I do it because I want them to be inspired. I want them to think that could be me someday. And so we too have seen extraordinary things, and we should share those things. We should also not be surprised by our thorns. We shouldn't be surprised by the fact that God is going to allow certain difficulties and limitations to persist in our lives. They're necessary. They might be the very thing that qualifies us to be fruitful in an ongoing way. Thirdly, and some of you guys are way ahead on this, let God begin to redeem your thorns. The things that we are weak in, the things that we struggle in, often become the things that qualify us to serve in the most important ways. I know there's many people here in this room who are former addicts, and your battle with slavery to addiction is the very thing that has allowed you to rescue other people. I'm grateful to Amanda, who got up, you know, earlier and spoke about her experience, something deadly, of great difficulty in their life, great pain. And I know that God is redeeming what is happening in that situation, not only to encourage other people, but they will also minister to other people who have suffered in similar ways in this broken world. And so let God redeem your thorns. One thing you have to be able to do in order to let this happen is you do have to be able to talk about your weaknesses. Maybe not your besetting sins on a front porch of 25 people you don't know that well, but you do have to be able to talk about your weaknesses. You do have to be able to talk about some of these things and share. There's some of us here, I mean, this will never be my problem. This will never be my problem. I've got plenty of other weaknesses and I wear them on my sleeve. But some of us, we are holding our cards too close to our chest. It's time to let people see things a little bit better and trust and believe that, God can let people observe us in process as we grow and as we change and as we deal in ways that are spiritual with these things, and that could have a real spiritual impact. And then finally, we should just be rejoicing that so much is accomplished despite us. I remember years and years ago, I think it was one of my first servant team retreats, hearing Dennis talk about the history of our church and then saying, looking back at the beginning of things, he was like, this didn't happen because of me, it happened in spite of me. And ironically, I was really inspired by that. I was like, man, that's actually pretty cool. God is doing so much in our fellowship. He's doing so much in our individual lives. Even though we're weak people, we're broken people. Even though we're limited in such important ways, even though our fellowship is limited in certain ways. You know, being persecuted openly, like in the media, is a form of a limitation, right? It means that now it changes the way that I interact with the strangers. It affects things in a way that I don't like. But you know, despite some of these problems, the Lord has allowed to persist in our fellowship, but also in our personal lives. So much is accomplished despite us. And that is just an opportunity to point people right to Jesus and say, that's right, we don't get the credit. God gets the credit because he uses weak and broken and foolish people like us to do powerful things for the kingdom.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.